This show was brought to you by Ouch My Ego. OuchMyEgo.com.
Hey, Rob.
Yeah?
You're back on the show.
I'm back after many, many cat years.
Cat years, yes. Yeah, so everybody should be familiar with you, at least a little bit, in that the shows that you usually are on have, not always, but sometimes, to do with music.
Yeah.
And because you're in a band.
Yeah, right? We talked about...
How many bands now?
I think it's...
What's your main focus?
That changes also... month okay. to month.
What are you doing right now?
I'm in a band called Slow Attack. That's like a four-piece, four humans.
It's an actual band.
It's an actual band. And then I do Block Numbers, which is me and like four synths.
You and four fake people.
Yeah.
Which are the synthesizers.
Yeah.
So I always like to get you to watch, and this is after Forbidden Zone, get you to watch things that are music-based, not necessarily musicals, though Forbidden Zone was. Yeah.
Or like True Stories.
True Stories, yes. So I think this is going to be the theme, if you don't mind. Mm-hmm. Something even minorly, like the, well, what did we just watch?
The Adventures of Buckaroo Banzai Across the Eighth Dimension.
He's a rocker. Doctor.
Don't tug on that. You never know what I might be attached to.
Inventor.
Activate oscillator.
Philosopher.
No matter where you go, there you are.
And the only hero.
Buckaroo.
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 Curse are you, Banzai.
Who can save us all.
Evil. Pure and simple from the eighth dimension. Save him.
Buckaroo Banzai is pure nutty fun. The cult sci-fi classic.
Run, run.
In a dimension all its own.
Real-life Martians landing in New Jersey.
Torito, Torito.
Vaporize the whole damn planet?
If we blow this today...
Get him up!
There ain't no tomorrow.
Left, I said left!
This is left!
I mean my left, all left, go your right!
Buckaroo, the president's calling about, is everything okay with the alien space cloud from Planet 10, or should we just go ahead and destroy Russia?
Tell him yes on one and no on two.
The Adventures of Buckaroo Banzai.
Which was yes, destroy Russia, or number two?
Like, this one minorly had to do with music.
Yeah, because they have a band, the... what are they called?
Hong Kong Cavaliers.
Yes. This movie... Yeah, like, there's so many things that, like, could be other movies. I thought that was going to be the whole movie. I was like, no, we're just going to do that for, like, 10 minutes and not even do a full song, not even give me the full, like, Peter Weller, like, heartbreaking piano performance. Which I really liked. His voice is good. I really like people that have unique voices, and when you can hear those unique voices on music.
Like At first, when he's singing, I was like, I don't really like this. But then he goes, da 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 da.
Yeah, when he's doing the minors with the piano.
Yeah, I was like, what?
It's like the John Goodman performance in True Stories. Like, I love, that's like a unique voice.
This is weird.
It doesn't just sound like pop star, real smooth voice. Like, there's character to that voice. And I think voices like that really add a lot to music.
So, let's get into Buckaroo himself. Who is Buckaroo Banzai?
He's like a weird Western archetype in an 80s rock band that dresses like they're from the 50s and inhabits the realm of, like, 60s sci-fi.
Okay.
So, it's like a mishmash of, like, all these, like, almost, like... sci-fi adventure kind of young man novel tropes wrapped in one character.
So I was looking at the documentary before watching the film again, and Peter Weller was explaining that he based his attire look and I guess the concept that he had for Buckaroo on Ilya Kazan, who is a director, and he always wore suits and he was like that, and then Jacques Cousteau.
Again, I knew it.
Because you mentioned that thing, and I was like, okay. So Jacques Cousteau, because Jacques Cousteau was a diver, he created the scuba.
Yeah.
He was a boatman, he was a documentarian, writer, etc. He was a man of many things.
A Renaissance man.
Renaissance, yes.
Mind, body, adventure, the unknown.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And the last one is Adam Ant.
Oh, nice.
He really liked how Adam Ant was with his get up and the new wave thing.
Yeah, stage persona.
Yeah. So he incorporated elements of that. Uh-huh. I wish it was a little heavier on the Adam Ant thing. Like, if he had the shoulder tassels and stuff, and maybe like that, or face paint, yeah. I would have been like,
hey. Well, I think Jeff Goldblum had that going.
Yeah.
And well, a few of the other guys did, so maybe they incorporated that more with the background.
Yeah, yeah.
The backup band.
Well, his Hong Kong Cavaliers, to me, is the ideal of pals. The ideal concept of having friends.
Well, yeah, because they also work with him in the science capacity.
Yeah.
They all have code names, so they're kind of like a collection of oddballs that all...
They're multicultural pals. This is an example of, like, Ice Pirates. We recorded Ice Pirates before this, and that also has an example of colorblind casting, where everybody is on equal footing. Nobody is, like, dismissed or diminished because they're a black guy or a Hispanic guy. The point is, in the 80s, there were only a few of these movies that did this colorblind casting, where it's just everybody's cool. It's presented that way, and that's how this movie was, and I loved it. I've always loved it that way. I don't know if you noticed that much.
No, it's hard for me to call it colorblind casting because you had, like, the one guy that looked Mexican. Like Reno.
No, he is.
But they're still very much auxiliary characters. They're on equal footing, but they still all listen to him.
Oh, sure.
They're still, like, the...
As he's written, he's half Japanese.
Yeah.
He's Peter Weller.
Yeah.
But he's half Japanese, as he's written in the deleted scenes, which you didn't see, and I don't know if they're actually included on this Shout Factory release. His mother is played by Jamie Lee Curtis.
Oh, wow.
Yeah, and it's just a deleted scene from the very big, like an earlier experiment, an alternate version of the 1938 experiment.
Oh, okay, that had her in there.
Yeah.
But I feel like that's already, like, that backstory is kind of busy, and you don't need to tie it with the
mother. Well, actually, so there's a 1938 experiment.
See this rock? It's solid matter, right? But in point of fact, the solid parts of this rock, the neutrons, quarks, protons, and electrons, comprise only about 1/4 of its total volume. The rest of this rock is actually only empty space. So back in 1937, Professor Akita here and Dr. Emilio Lizardo figured that if solid matter were mostly just empty space, a person should be able to discover a way to travel inside things.
And then there was one that happened also in the 50s, and that was the one in the 50s because Peter Weller was of that age. So, and he was in that clip as a little boy. So, but yeah, his dad's a Japanese, I think, scientist as well. So, but yeah, it's a thing that they did. It's never perfect. I mean, Brother from Another Planet is one that was not even just colorblind casting, but it had a black lead who was an alien in New York. And it's a very gritty film, and it's a very serious film because he's, one, an alien from outer space. It's like The Man Who Fell to Earth, but Inner City, black, and it's written by John Sayles, a white man who actually kind of understands things about how city life was back in 1984 or 82 when it came out. I like when race isn't really acknowledged.
Yeah.
In movies.
Yeah, it never was either. It was just like, these are just all my... This is my crew.
Yeah. So that's what I'm saying. So, because in the 80s, when they did have the black lead doing something like that, it was acknowledged. The race thing was acknowledged, and it was about a plight in that sense.
But I also feel that comes out of, like, Star Trek, too. Like, it's like, we're like, light years, literally. Like, we're, like, just so far in the future that that's not a thing anymore.
Right.
Even though this wasn't set in the future. I don't know what time that was supposed to be set in.
I think it's supposed to be contemporary 1984.
Okay. I couldn't tell if it was, like, a weird 50s, a weird 80s. I mean, a lot of the shots or the locations could be anywhere.
That's a thing that happens in the 80s. I mentioned to you another movie, Streets of Fire, where when is this? And it's very rockabilly, very 50s looking in certain themes. But then, of course, they have modern cars and stuff like that. So it's this thing that happened in the fantastic world of 80s movies. Interestingly enough, this movie wasn't a cocaine film, which is usually what crazy movies are. They're cocaine movies where the guy's like, yeah, sure, whatever.
Yeah,
yeah, I'll sign whatever, just that we need to make a movie that's weird.
Yeah, and no, this felt more like, it had more heart to it, I feel like. Yeah, it's got the kid in there, like, again, playing back to that, like, adventure. But yeah, when you bring up that Jacques Cousteau thing, I remember I commented really early, like, this reminds you of what, or I imagine this is what Wes Anderson wanted to copy when he did The Life Aquatic. Not the whole adventure, but just, like, that idea of the guy with the crew, larger than life. They're all outcasts from, you know, all over the world. And he even brings that up. He's like, we're just a bunch of outcasts. Like, he used to drive a bus. Like, we're just not important, but what we do together is important.
And yeah, well, that's the thing about the ideal pals thing.
Yeah.
Is that everybody has a role. Like, for you and me, your role is actually being on my show.
Yeah.
Not necessarily the only role, but, like, this is one thing that you and I bond with, I think, is doing this podcast sometimes. I find that to be very cool because you always come with an interesting or newer or different perspective.
Mm-hmm.
And I really, really appreciate that.
Yeah. Well, even if I don't like things, they make me think of other things, and I feel like watching a movie like this brings up a lot of concepts that I probably wasn't going to think about this week.
Oh.
Or you know what I mean? Like, yeah. Movies, like, good movies will excite you even if they're not what you like. Mm-hmm. If they're not catering exactly to what I want.
Right.
I think that this is like any good piece of art.
So
like,
what's...
comes
what's,
out of left field. Like,
what's the plot here? If you can.
Buckaroo Banzai is testing some sort of land speed record car or something, and he's like, screw it, I'm just going to go through the eighth dimension just for the hell of it.
Well, he has the oscillation over thruster, which is a device that a scientist pal of his, one of the Hong Kong Cavaliers, I guess.
But they just like put it in the car without the people testing it knowing it, because they had it like literally covered with a blanket.
Right, so they put it in the car. Yes, and then he exactly goes off course and veers into a mountain where, what the heck?
You just kind of see a bunch of electron microscope.
I'm wondering how they did that graphically, how they did that stuff.
Yeah. I was like, oh, he's just going into like an atomic little picture of what this is, what everything looks like. It's like,
but
that
it
footage.
It seems all strangely animated, almost like it's CG at some points, but then other times it does seem like just a...
No, it seems like they got real images footage. And then just did some kind of like key color messing with it, or maybe kind of warped it with video.
And then there's these little dudes that are floating around inside of
that is very like early CG, like, which
so
is cool.
They're just... flopping around.
They're flopping around almost like these weird like fetal creatures. But apparently they were trapped in there and he released them by accident.
Yeah.
And so the rest of the movie is him having to clean up the mess that he started, because the race of people from Planet 10, the aliens who imprisoned them, are like, if you don't fix this, we're just going to blow up your planet, because that guy can't.
Yeah, he's worse than Hitler.
Yes.
He's as bad as your Earth's Hitler.
Yes, even though he was technically Mussolini, which was as bad as Hitler, because they were both fascists.
All right, so this guy is played by John Lithgow, and he... did perform it thinking Mussolini and Mozart.
Oh, okay.
So the frazzled nature is the Mozart. Lewis Smith is the guy talking about, like, constantly referencing Mussolini and Mozart. And Lithgow performs it. His name is John Warfin as the alien. An alien is inside of him.
Yeah.
Puppeting his body. And he gets high, basically, or, like, energized by literally putting electricity through his veins, I suppose. Through his tongue. Hooks himself up and electrocutes himself. But anyway, his performance is Italian because he had a tailor who was Italian, and he was like, I like how this guy talks. He's authentic Italian who's been in America for a long time, so he has a handle on the language. However, he hasn't shed his
accent.
Yeah. So he had him read the entire script, all of his lines, into a recorder, and then practice that.
Oh, wow. That's cool.
Intonation. And then when he did his own version of it, he just turned it up. He just turned up the crazy enunciations and so. And so that's how he's this insane Italian guy.
Not for while you can, monkey boy.
Well, that guy wants to get back to where he's from, because how... John Lithgow, that's the 1938 I mentioned.
Yeah.
The 1938 experiment, he just jumped the gun. The portal wasn't ready to go through. He just jumped the gun. He got too excited and just got half put into it. Half of him sticking out of a wall, and the other half is the other dimension, eighth dimension.
I guess somehow they just...
John Warfin possessed him.
Yeah.
Somehow. It's an 80s movie. A lot of 80s movies have somehow this happened.
Well, I like that they never tried to explain it in a dumb way. You're like, oh my god, John Warfin is inside him. Or like, there was never that stupid moment for the audience to go like, oh, you know what I mean?
Yeah, there's just a scene where Buckaroo shows up to the Hong Kong Cavaliers, and they're like, hey, we figured a lot of this stuff out while you were gone.
Yes.
Perfect
exposition. Like, here you go. That's what happens when you have a team of people working for you. The audience doesn't need to be like in on everything.
Right.
You feel more like you're walking through the nerve center of this operation, and you don't feel as much like a viewer, but you're more, it's like more of like a fly in the wall kind of thing. And I like movies to do that. Again, I'm sure that's what Wes Anderson was trying to do with The Life Aquatic, because there's so many things going on, it's so detailed, and it's like, no, just look at it for a second, keep going. And this movie excels in that. There's so much detail everywhere. The sets are great.
Now,
the costumes are great. The performances are great.
There's a woman in this movie. Her name is Penny Pretty.
Yeah.
And this is a very strange introduction to a character. They're playing on stage as their band. First, he does brain surgery with Jeff Goldblum.
Yeah.
Then asks Jeff Goldblum if he'd like to join the band. And then goes through the mountain.
I wasn't sure if those were supposed to be in chronological order, or you're just seeing, like...
No, that's it. As it happens, that's how it unfolds.
So he left brain surgery and then did the mountain thing. And then did the performance.
Yes, and then did the performance and stops a suicidal woman from killing herself.
Did he, though? Like, it looked like somebody moved her arm?
Well, he tries to console her, but somebody did bump her arm, and the gun goes off. We don't necessarily know if she was just being dramatic or what, but she seems rather suicidal, and the gun comes out from nowhere.
Yeah.
Which, again,
well, they all had guns, too, which is like...
a gun goes off, and they all pull out Uzis and stuff.
The drummer had an Uzi. Also, I was going to say most of the guns also were not. The Uzi was the only like kind of modern gun, and then that kid.
Everything's a revolver.
Yeah, everything's a revolver. The Mexican guy, I think Reno, had like kind of a World War I machine gun with the side loading magazine.
So they're like the Howling Commandos.
Yes! They're like World War I or World War II era. Yeah, throw that in there too. It's kind of like the Dirty Dozen as well. Yeah, it's just like everything good about young male adventure tropes thrown in there.
Right, but it's also what you're saying good. There's not a sexist moment here.
No.
They're lawful good characters, which is something that totally always has appealed to me.
Yeah.
I love it. Legend of Billie Jean, our hero in that, she's lawful good. And so there's never a bad thing that she does. Even though she's an outlaw, there's never a bad thing that she does. Twin Peaks, Dale Cooper, lawful good, my favorite character on TV.
Very much like a White Hats.
Yeah, but it all depends on how you play him. If that can be boring, right? But is Peter Weller boring in this?
No, he's not.
Are his buddies, who are also lawful good, boring?
No, because they're so kind of...
Each are unique.
Cartoony in a good way. Like, you can easily remember them. Like, Perfect Tommy.
Oh, Perfect Tommy's funny.
Great, yeah.
He's kind of always kind of one step behind, except he's Perfect Tommy, because he's like this beautiful guy.
Yeah.
And I think it's more than just skin deep.
Let her out.
Yeah, let her out. I'll be responsible.
She's a killer.
No, she's not. And give her your coat.
Why me?
Because you're perfect.
You have a point there.
So he does. But he's always like a step behind on some of the information. Except for that.
And then he's also really into strike teams, because they kind of mentioned like no strike teams. And then later on the second time he's like, strike team? And they're like, no, let's not do that. And then the third time they're finally like, he's in his element, because they're like, you lead the strike team.
Yep.
Little callbacks. I appreciate like the humor in this movie is so good. Or like the watermelon, like, which is like a total Jeff Goldblum line.
Yeah.
The way he delivers it.
It's just a scene where they're walking through the inner workings of...
A lab.
This lab. It's their own lab.
Yeah.
And Reno is in front of them, and Jeff Goldblum hesitantly, curiously, as he always does, says...
Why is there a watermelon there?
I'll tell you later.
It's just a watermelon on, like...
It looks like
water heaters or something like that, or some mechanical...
It looked like a... What do you call them? Like a compress. Something that smashes something.
Okay. Well, that's what it looked like to you. I was thinking that, too, because there's something above it. Like a shelf or a, I don't know, cabinet. I don't know. Something above it, but then...
A clamp.
Yeah. It's amazing. It's a really great scene.
Yeah.
There's no explanation
for it. There's no payoff for it. Nothing.
He doesn't explain the watermelon later. It's just a little neat, odd thing, because I guess that's how life is, right?
Yeah. That's how this movie is. That's how life in this movie is.
Well, I think life is like that a lot. I want to say something to somebody, and I'll go and start it, and then something interrupts, and I'll never come back to it. Or I will, but it'll be 3 days later, and the person's like, what are you talking about?
Yeah. Right.
So... 3 days later, Jeff Goldblum gets the answer about the watermelon. We just don't know about it.
Yeah.
So Penny Pretty, though, she's played by Ellen Barkin. What do you think about this character?
I, at first, didn't know why that character was kind of put into the film. It seems like a weird way to do a not gay for this guy that only hangs around with guys. She looks just like his old wife that we see in one photo, conveniently placed. I don't know. It's an odd... Because even when they're trying to save her, they're not really trying to save her. They're trying to save the... what is it called? The thruster? The
oscillation overthruster.
The overthruster. So, and then even her as a character is like, oh, I'm not worth it. Like, even she knows she was kind of thrown in just to be the damsel in distress. Like,
I'm not worth it, Buckaroo. Forget about me. They'll never break me.
Penny, get off the phone.
No, I don't really. What does she know about overthrusting? She's not a scientist.
Then, shall we say, a penny for your thoughts?
It's kind of a sly play on, like, you need the damsel in distress, but you kind of don't.
It's interesting that you point out that they're not necessarily over-concerned with rescuing her, but saving the day in total for everybody else. So she could literally be collateral damage.
And
they
would
be like,
and it
like
would still be...
Three of their other dudes get killed, and we see two of them get killed, at least. And they're like, so-and-so's dead. And they're like, oh, crap. Let's go.
Yeah, the only one who got like a little bit of a death, kind of a deathbed scene was Rawhide. Another cowboy name.
Yeah, yeah.
Rawhide, Reno, Nevada. Perfect Tommy doesn't really fit in that, but
Clancy Brown is Rawhide. He actually dies. That stinks, and I forgot that he dies because he's like the other character. There's Perfect Tommy and him who are the main sidekicks.
Yeah, they're like his, I guess, second in command, like his lieutenants.
Yeah, but when he dies, it's just a tender little quiet scene.
Yeah, it's very much...
He, like, goes to sleep.
Yeah, it's very much a cowboy death scene, because he's like, what does he say, like, y'all still got work to do or something?
Yeah, and so then there's Reno, Nevada, as you said, who's played by Pepe Serna. He's also the saxophonist.
Yeah.
And Perfect Tommy is Lewis Smith. Jeff Goldblum is New Jersey, who dresses as a cowboy.
That's also a great joke.
A literal buckaroo.
Yeah. Because, yeah, they're like, where are you from? And you assume he's going to say... Texas, and he's like, New Jersey. It's one of those great misdirection jokes.
Yeah, yeah. Like. And Billy Vera is Pinky Carruthers, and there are other characters in the Hong Kong Cavaliers that don't necessarily have names, but the Blue Blaze Irregulars are that's the helicopter crew.
Well, I thought he just had people that all over the country that are just...
it's like Fight Club, literally. It's like all the space monkeys in Fight Club in every city, in every state, or every major, like, let's say the capital of every state has a group, and they're called Irregulars, I do believe.
Well, because in this universe, there are also comic books about this guy.
Yeah, so he's like this world-renowned hero.
Yeah.
So Blue Blaze Irregulars is one of them, but there's another group that rolls up.
Oh, yeah, they never showed them.
It was the Rugsuckers. Yes. That's where he's like, go ahead, call in the Rugsuckers. And then you see this van. All it is a front for a Buckaroo Banzai strike team, which their front is vacuum cleaners.
Well, essentially cleaners, because when you call them in, you're cleaning out the bad guys.
That's what he did, too. He's like, I'll go in, and you guys come and clean up.
Yeah.
So the whole point is for John Lithgow to get his Lectroids, the red Lectroids, the bad ones, back to his home planet. That's all he wants to do. But if he goes back to his home planet, he's going to try to start his whole Mussolini thing over again.
Yeah.
So black Lectroids figure this out, and they don't want that to happen. And then they also tell Buckaroo, you guys accidentally, we know it's an accident, but you guys accidentally started this up again. You guys gotta
stop John Warpin before sunset.
And so there's Cold War stuff going
on. And they also gave him the very Western deadline of by sunset.
You're right.
Yeah, like, there's no reason for an alien race to say do this by sunset. Why would they have their timetable be on our planets? But again, it's going back to those, like, Western kind of devices to tell a sci-fi story.
Right, well, Westerns seem to be a template for a lot of movies.
Yeah, also another favorite of mine that's very much in the same vein, like Big Trouble Little China, because supposedly that was going to be a Western.
I heard about that.
Yeah, it was written as a Western, and then... it went through all these development changes, but Kurt Russell still played it like John Wayne.
Right.
But yeah, going back to this, it's a really nice way to play with those ideas without doing a Western. And it's also a really cool way to do something that people are already familiar with. It's like, you're in the middle of this insane sci-fi story, but you still understand.
Yeah.
You know, we're speaking because
there are conventions, as you're saying. Mm-hmm. And what was the most popular genre in American cinema up until sometime in the 70s was the Western.
Yeah.
So it's still in the language, everybody's language. Once it stopped being popular in cinema, it was being shown on TV ad infinitum.
Yeah.
So...
well, I mean, yeah, I could go even more in depth into that about, like, the whole American myth of, like, the frontiersman. That's, like, a huge part of Manifest Destiny. And even up into Vietnam, I was... actually rereading a book I had to read for a class on Vietnam, and it talked about how the Green Berets were like the new frontiersmen. They were the white man going into the frontier and using the techniques of the savage to kind of conquer it. But at the same time, it was an altered version, because the Green Berets were not only going to defeat the communists, they were also going to win over the Vietnamese by offering medicine and offering help. And it's kind of a revision of American mission in light of kind of the guilt felt over. Instead of just screwing over the native people like we did last time, and destroying them, now we are going to bring them up with us, and America will be that shining beacon unto the world and defeat world communism by being the good guys this time.
Right. So, speaking of commie stuff, there is that underlying this whole thing, too.
Yes.
Where the Black Electroid, or is it just the Black Electroid, or is it the Red Electroid technology is kind of interfering with electronics in the White House, at least?
I think it's the black ones.
Okay, so the Black Electroid stuff is causing them to kind of...
just by their presence being around the Earth, they're kind of causing static...
electromagnetic problems. Yeah. So Americans are kind of huffing about, should we or shouldn't we go to Code Red? If we go to Code Red, the Russians will go to Code Red, and the Kremlin, we don't want them to think too ill of us in this situation, because everything is always tender.
Buckaroo, President's on line one calling about, is everything okay with the alien space cloud from planet 10, or should he just go ahead and destroy Russia?
Tell him yes on one and no on two.
Which was yes, destroy Russia or number two?
So, I found that to be rather interesting.
Oh, wow. I didn't even think about that. Well, that was the main problem of the Cold War. You can't have the frontiersmen doing that. It's out of an individual's hands. These are, like, state powers. And it's mutually assured destruction if anybody makes a move.
Mm-hmm.
So, that idea of American kind of purpose cannot be done on the state level. It has to be taken away from the bureaucracy, which is just a bad echo of the European past and the colonies, the colonization. Right. It has to be done by this rugged individual.
Now, the rugged individual here is Buckaroo Banzai and his team of Hong Kong Cavaliers, which is just really fun to say.
Yeah.
Now, the bad guys are fascinating.
It's like the 80s rogues gallery of my favorite creepy kid actors. Or not, they're not kid actors. My favorite creepy
actors
when I was a kid.
Yeah. So you have Dan Hedaya. You have Vincent Schiavelli.
That's his name.
Yeah. You have Christopher Lloyd.
Yeah,
those are our main three. The other Electroids, who are the good Electroids, is Rosalind Cash as the projection, hologram.
Yeah, kind of like the ambassador or something.
And Carl Lumbly as John Parker. And he ends up being the ally to Buckaroo Banzai. Now, all these Electroids are named John. Every single one of them.
Yes.
And they all have strange... Well, not necessarily every single one of them has strange last names, but John O'Connor, not too strange. John Gomez, not too strange.
John Roberts, John Milton. We took a picture of the list of names that came out on the computer readout. Like you said, normal ones. John Wood, John Camp.
All these people applied for Social Security cards in the same town in New Jersey on the exact same date.
They all got the same first name. John, 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 John.
These are Martian names. John Webb, John Fat Eating, John Icicle Boy.
John Smallberries? It's a joke.
Martians. In New Jersey.
And then like John Many Jars, John Chief Crier, John Little John is a good one. John Little John, John Starboard, and our favorite John Smallberries.
Yeah. Who's actually seen in the film. Though, in the film and on the readout, he's two different actors.
Yeah. That's true.
Yeah.
Yeah, on the screen.
He's like a middle-aged guy, and then in the scene, that guy is a younger man.
Oh, and John Yaya was the other guard, and he's on this list, too.
Oh, he is. Okay.
John Two Horns. Some of these sound like Native American names, but yeah. John Milton.
John Milton's on there?
He's one of them.
John Nephew. John Guardian, John Scott, and the featured John, played by Christopher Lloyd, is John Big Bootay.
Yeah, which he has to keep reminding people that it's Big Bootay.
One more word out of your Big Booty! Big Bootay! Tay, Tay!
Yeah, so Whorfin, which is Whorfin, John Whorfin, is John Lithgow's alien, and we never see an alien counterpart of his. Even
because he's just inside. I thought about that, too.
Consciousness of him.
Once the audience gets the vision that Buckaroo Banzai has, like his kind of like they live moment where he can just see them.
Yeah. Buckaroo is able to see them because he picks up a phone, which he thinks is the president, and he gets electrocuted, which is an electrical signal that the black Electroids send to him, helping him decode the facade that they have up in front of him. And then they replicate it later.
Later on, because he gave the formula to...
He wrote it on his hand, yeah.
And put it on his scientist's forehead. Which, again, like, when you're describing this to me, and I'm like... That was never explicitly told to me, but it made sense in the movie, and the movie never stopped to tell me that.
Mm-hmm.
It was just, here's all this stuff happening.
This movie doesn't treat you like an idiot.
Yes, that's why I loved it. And that's why I'm saying you can't make a movie like this now. It would be 2.5 hours long, because they would spend time like, what happened? Oh, they must have sent you a signal. You know, Ugh, I love movies like this.
And Show Don't Tell. I'm really fond of Show Don't Tell, if you don't have to. I'm also in writing, as far as like writing an article or short story or whatever, the least amount of words is better for me. And you can still be cool sounding or clever sounding, but the second you start muddying up the sentence that you just want to say, the man went to the store, you just say the man went to the store. You don't have to throw in 30 more words to make it sound smart or whatever.
Yes, and they also never try to explain their tech, which I also love. Just like, we have it now.
Yeah.
Because I didn't even think about that, but when they have the vests, mm-hmm. it's like, oh, we worked up these vests so you can breathe in.
Oh, no, they did explain it, and it was awesome. It was really fast, and as they were handing this stuff out to people, it was Jeff Goldblum.
Yeah.
He was in the background just mumbling stuff to himself.
And which breathing it in, and then
he's like, so, so we can do this, and it's bacteria, and it goes up, and then somebody then says the one sentence where it's like, it's programming your brain through electricity or something like that. Very quick and easy.
Yeah, and it's while they're putting it on, so you don't need to waste time in the debrief room before we get into the vehicle while we're suiting up. And then, it's like, just go. Ah, economy of storytelling. So good.
Yeah. So this movie...
How long was this movie? It didn't feel long.
1 hour and 43 minutes. Oh, there's a War of the Worlds reference here, mm-hmm. which is interesting. To bring it back to what you're talking about, kind of callbacks to previous history. Like, we're talking about the Western thing.
Yeah.
Everybody's familiar with that. But in science fiction, everybody's also familiar with one of the granddaddy of sci-fi stuff, H.G. Wells' War of the Worlds, as performed by Orson Welles.
Yes.
And it takes place in Grover's Mill. And I'm not so familiar with the... I've listened to it once, maybe, mm-hmm. with the radio play. And then I've seen various movie versions of it. But it's not something that I'm always thinking about. But the second somebody says Grover's Mill, I'm like, where have I heard that before?
Yeah.
And that's what happened in this movie. I was like, wait. So I scrambled to figure it out before they even say it in the movie. And yeah, it's War of the Worlds. And I was like, right. Okay. So it's a clever tie-in to the past. Almost like maybe X-Files would do with the Roswell stuff.
Yeah, and they're kind of repurposing it for their story
in
a way, which is really nice and subtle.
They hypnotized Orson Welles into covering it up. So first he says there's an invasion from Mars, but then he says, no, it's just a radio show hoax. Get it?
So when John Lithgow was sent the script to do this as the villain, he had come off of The World According to Garp, in which he played a transvestite. And he was going up for an Oscar, I think, for that. But when he was given this script, he was like, I don't want to have anything to do with this. This is just too weird.
Mm-hmm.
And his agent talked him into meeting with D.W. Richter, the director, and the other authors. And the writer sat down and said, so have you picked out your Oscar dress? And so then he was like, oh, crap, I'm working with you guys.
Yeah.
You guys are funny. There's a context to the Garp thing where he's a cross-dresser or whatever. So that's how he decided to just go ahead and, yes, I'll do this job. And I'm glad for it because his performance is insane.
Amazing, like, physically, vocally, just, yeah.
Like, every time when he has his big speech over all of his electroids to get the job done, after every time he says a line, waiting for their responses, his face, it's weird, I don't know how an actor can do this, but his face almost folds in on itself. And his whole body does, but his face does too. So he's like, we must get this done! And then his face folds in. And it's a pause that he does. And it's every time. And it's super bizarre to see. Yeah, so physicality is amazing.
He's waiting for the response, because it's like very much a call and response kind of...
when are we leaving?
Dictatorial speech.
Yeah. Real soon!
Yeah, real soon.
So there's like a lot of silly, dumb humor in this, and it plays out like it's not dumb or silly. It's just good.
Because none of it is like lowbrow.
Yeah.
It's throwaway humor, like little nuggets for, if you get the joke, cool. If not, like,
it's still funny.
Yeah.
So this movie was on all the time on basic cable and syndication packages, where they get a package of 4 or 5 movies from the studio, and you're a local. Like,
every Sunday.
Local channel. Yeah, it's a Saturday or Sunday.
Okay.
But I saw this first when I was like 88 or something, and I was hanging out with this kid, Eric. And he had it on. He had all of the great sci-fi stuff. He had Dune. He had various Star Trek movies. He had this movie. Possibly later, Big Trouble in Little China. So he was always tapped in with really great sci-fi for me. And he's how I started with liking weird movies or exploring weird movies. Is from him. And I didn't even know this until recently. And yeah, so saw that with him first. And I was like, this is just too strange. I'm 13. I'm like, what? what? And then I go home and finally it's on over there throughout into the 90s and I'm just like rolling in it.
Yeah, see, I totally missed it. I never saw this on syndication. Down here in South Texas, the four movies that we had on rotation that the local Channel 4 would show, and they would have the guy selling vinyl siding. Like,
yes.
We'll get you right back to Bloodsport in a second. So it was
Bloodsport?
It was Bloodsport. I can't knock them. I've seen them so many times because of that, and maybe that's why I like them.
Right.
Like you said, it's like they're not great, but they are.
With movies, a lot of times familiarity doesn't necessarily breed contempt.
Yeah.
Especially when you're young seeing that.
Yeah. So it was Bloodsport, Predator.
Okay.
Oh, they're going to kill me for not remembering this. I know Manny. Or no, Joseph has it memorized by
heart.
Yeah,
probably.
But it was, yeah, Bloodsport, Predator. I want to say maybe, I want to say it was Big Trouble in Little China, but I don't think it was. I think I just saw that a lot.
Yeah.
But it was definitely Bloodsport and Predator, like every other weekend. Oh, and the first Terminator.
Okay. All right.
So it was just like your kind of the biggest 80s action movie.
Right.
So, and Bloodsport.
Yeah. And Bloodsport.
I want to say there was a Stallone one in there. There must have been.
Cobra?
Maybe Cobra.
I'm thinking like just a dumb Stallone thing that didn't quite do
it may have been a Rambo movie. Maybe First Blood. Yeah. Although I feel like...
Well, First Blood was...
That's actually a good movie.
It's a solid. So solid.
But I feel like so is Predator because I've seen it so much.
No, Predator's pretty all right too.
Yeah.
I wonder what the TV edit is. I don't recall seeing a TV edit because they have to cut out all of the dialogue at the beginning of the movie.
Yes,
because
they do.
Shane Black, who wrote the dang thing, is also the worst.
I bet there's no helicopter scene. They're just already there. Like they just already show up and
Shane Black just goes and that's the only noise he makes.
The movie starts with Carl Weathers and Schwarzenegger's like bulging arms. Just
right.
Like,
so okay, here's something interesting. Too. We're talking about this ultra machismo movie right now.
Yes.
We're talking about Predator. And Buckaroo Banzai seems to be antithesis to that.
Yeah.
This is brainy dudes. They're also really masculine dudes in the brainy dude bunch, but this is brainy dudes.
Yeah.
Tall dudes, short dudes, black, white, Hispanic, Asian even. Yeah. And they're all smart and they're not just going to go into a place and shoot it up.
Yeah.
And that's also like, it's literally the antithesis to a Predator type film.
Yeah.
Which is fantastic.
Well, yeah, he's a brain surgeon, but he's bored. He's a bored brain surgeon. So it says in the opening crawl, like he just wants to do more than that.
Yeah.
So I don't know if the comic started coming out when he was a brain surgeon.
Or, who knows?
Or like after he started having adventures. I don't know. But yeah, this movie makes it seem really cool to be smart.
Yeah.
Which also an awesome thing to see as a kid. You know, not just, you know, Predator or Bloodsport. Like, you just have to beat up people to be cool.
Right.
Or massacre a small town sheriff's department. You know, like, yeah, this movie, like, plays up the science, plays up the diversity. It never feels like diversity. They're just all,
that's,
like you said.
That's the only way I ever liked this, by the way.
The
current climate where everything is, like, hammering you over the head about diversity of any sort, it's hammering. And you do not get the positive result through bludgeoning.
Yeah.
And this movie is perfect for that. It's a little flawed because there's two characters that are female. One of them is Mrs. Johnson, who is another one of his assistants, and she's the one who goes and talks to the president.
Yeah.
Which is, she's like the lady who's...
I don't know what her job is. Her function is.
Her function is to keep...
Is she like the PR person, maybe?
Or
she's like...
She's
in charge of like day-to-day operations.
Yeah, that.
She's just there at the house when they get there.
Like, and then they're like, we got this and that and whatever. And then she goes and talks to the president as he's doing his adventure stuff, which is... kind of unheard of. You don't usually have somebody who just keeps a house be the liaison also for the president, which is cool. But
again, everyone in his team can do more than one thing.
What I was saying is a little lopsided towards the boys, but it's all really good messages for the boys.
Yeah.
And especially how they treat everybody.
Yeah.
So
I mean, that's like the best you can hope for in the 80s, I think, at that time. This is definitely not like...
This being the best that you could hope for in the 80s, this is also possibly really close to the best thing from the 80s, I think. As far as like a standard of how to be a good person, a decent person.
Oh, a decent guy.
Guy. There you go. Yeah, so that's...
Movies at that point are still very much like just for guys.
Yeah.
Movies for guys who like movies on TBS, I think. Yeah. That was really a...
Right. Now, if they constantly played this, a lot of dudes now might be even more cool.
Yeah, the world would be a better place.
I'm not just assuming all dudes are not cool. Just about everybody's a dork, though, me included.
Yeah, but I do get that. Like,
so, do you recommend watching this film?
I am going to watch it again, actually. I want to get the Blu-ray now. And because now I want to know. I want to see the documentary. I want to see the little things that I kind of missed as the movie was happening. And like,
yeah, the documentary is longer than the actual film.
Which is a good sign.
Yeah,
I like stuff like that.
And unfortunately, some of the actors have since passed, I do believe. But the documentary has as many actors as they could talk about their time on the film.
Well, that was the cool thing. When I saw Peter Weller, I was like, I thought Peter Weller was only in like, I mean, he is only in a handful of movies.
Well, he did a lot of,
like, as a lead,
smaller cop type or gumshoe type films,
yeah,
too, before and after RoboCop.
Yeah.
And after RoboCop just stopped his career dead right there, and he didn't do anything further that you would expect him to do, because the guy has great command over his voice and his presence on film. And then RoboCop, he does two movies and he's like, this is gonna kill my career, and it kind of did.
Yeah.
I'm not gonna say totally, because I'm sure he's done lots more substantial stuff. I just haven't seen it.
But yeah, it's just not in the public consciousness at all. Like, he's making work. He's still making good work, I'm sure.
So I love this movie, and I love forgetting things in this movie. So when I watch it again, I'm like, oh, right! Or, what? That happened? Like, when she was going to kill herself. I forgot that even happened. And that just took me by surprise. So, I love this movie. I recommend it. Definitely.
It's definitely one of the best 80s movies. And I just saw it right now, and I can already put it up there. It's, with my favorite. Not the best, but my favorite.
No, that's a testament to how good this film is, that you're not doing it from a nostalgia base.
Yeah.
Which, I actually have a bit of nostalgia base for this as to why I like it so much. You have none.
None. And
I can say
it's one of my favorite 80s movies now.
Awesome. Well, thank you very much for joining me again.
Thanks for having me.
I'll make you watch something else music related, I think, most likely.
All right.
Next time. Good night, everybody.
Good night.
Where have I heard that before?